Hello and welcome to Skeleton Songs.
Spooky hello. We were going to talk about unreliable narrators today, but the more we set up for that, the more we realised it's probably more interesting to talk about reliable narrators. Because when you stop to think about it, it's weird that you have reliable narrators in a novel, isn't it? Because we spend a lot of time saying there's two sides to every story. Raise your hand if you're not driving and believe there's two sides to every story. And then keep your hand up if you believe there's two sides to every story, if it's a fictional story.
Why driving?
Because I don't want people to go off the road and die.
Oh, okay. This is a safety first podcast.
Oh, yes.
It's important. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's not so much necessarily the two sides to every story, although of course that's true. I think it's also depends how philosophical we want to get about it. I mean, you know, you can get into the whole ream of what is truth and this Baudrillardian concept that if you don't personally experience it, and even then it will only be a facet of the truth, there isn't really a truth.
And I think
that tends to end up in Reddit forums.
So exactly. So this is why we want to talk about reliable narrators rather than unreliable narrators, because as soon as you start talking about the relativity of truth, there's usually a pause for someone to take a hit from a bong. And this is a bong-free podcast.
I was just going to say, I would like to confirm there are zero bongs. Both you and I probably are not bong-friendly people.
Apart from Big Ben, which, to be clear, is a UK landmark and not a particularly large bong.
We're also euphemism-free, although sometimes you might think otherwise.
Reliable narrators. It's very difficult to think of a circumstance when you are telling an anecdote from your life and you put everything in. And it's very difficult to think of a novel where you know literally everything that would happen to the characters in the same way that you would if you had a camera running 24/7. And it's very difficult to think about a documentary or a reality show that has cameras running 24/7 that doesn't still make editorial choices. And it's very difficult to, I forgot the last thing I was going to, games, yeah. So if you think about really, really detailed simulations in games, the detailed simulations leave a lot out. I wrote a piece about this to gamesindustry.biz years ago. And I mean, toilets, obviously.
Oh my God.
But that's exactly the thing. It's, oh my God. So
literally less than 3 minutes in.
1,000 pages of Lord of the Rings and we don't see anybody have a poo.
No, because that guy has class.
But that's exactly the thing. They're camping. And when you've been camping, you know latrines are an issue.
I'm not talking about my experiences of this.
And my point is that you're right. Tolkien has class, so he doesn't talk about Aragorn's bottom. But
oh my God, you see, I thought we were going to go down the much more academic route of, you know, move this to its extreme, and it's the map that is the size of the world, because that's the only way to fully represent the world, is to make a facsimile that is exactly the same as the world, thus reducing the point of having a map. But no, we went down the latrines and bums route.
That's the same point. But this is the thing, is Tolkien is right to leave out the latrines. I don't think it would add anything. If you're writing a gritty fantasy thing that reminded us how muddy the Middle Ages were, then he would. And similarly, I can think of a lot of simulations, which game simulations which include toilets and plumbing, and I can think of a lot which don't, and I don't think either one is better than the other. But for example, you know, RimWorld, a gritty survival sim, doesn't have toilets. Prison Architect, a gritty prison management sim, does have toilets, because we think more about toilets when we think about prisons.
Some people don't think about toilets.
Did you know
are we distilled the riff?
This is the riff, but it's relevant. In Prison Architect, female prisoners are modelled as having a higher hygiene need than male prisoners.
I think that's a very interesting decision that the designer has made.
Right? And the designers, in fact, I believe, but both men, as far as I know. And so I think many people would expect that women often have more exacting hygiene standards than men. And many people would say maybe that's sexist.
I think men just need to pull their socks up, frankly.
Well, the particular reason that they...
Letting the side down.
That they wanted to represent women as having a higher hygiene need is because menstruation's an issue in women's prisons.
Hmm. No, I'd understood that.
Sorry, the half of our audience who are men might not have. I mean, it didn't occur to me when I was thinking
right.
of this.
Okay.
Or again, my other favourite example is that basically the London Marathon is always won by Kenyans or Ethiopians for genetic and environmental reasons. But if you put if you built a marathon simulator that represented, you know, it always being won by Kenyans and Ethiopians, then that would raise some complicated issues. So there's always editorialising, even when something looks like a simulation, and take it back out to the old literature. There are decisions being made about what to put in a piece of fiction all the time. Mm. And it's fine for us not to notice those decisions, but it's interesting for us to notice them.
Mm. And even when there's often a distinction drawn between the type of narrator, whether it's first person, whether it's sort of framed, whether it's epistolary, and most people would probably say that the most believable narrator, the most trustworthy narrator, is the third person omniscient narrator, which is essentially me saying, you know, Alexis went over and did that thing, and there's no implication on the page that I am deliberately doing something cunning, or that you are in any way likely to not be doing what I have just said that you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But even that, as you say, because it is not representing everything, it's not saying it was Tuesday the 31st of whatever, and he had hair that looked a bit crazy and the wind was this degree.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actively, despite the act of streamlining reality into a narrative, making quite an interesting choice about how much you can actually trust it.
It is, and it's interesting you say that, because one of the things that games and interactive narratives do differently from traditional literature is they tend to use the second person, which is not unknown in traditional literature. I think
not a fan of it.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think a friend of ours actually just did it in her second book.
Well, I take that back. It's great, apart from when Jeanette Winterson does it. We're still in a fight.
Anyway, so generally, if you're reading a piece of interactive narrative, it will say you fall down a pit. Do you A, bewail your plight, or B, play a jaunty tune on your harmonica? And in Fawn and London, equally, we said you. In Son of Sea, everything I wrote said you, and everything everyone else had wrote said you.
Again, just a proviso for people who haven't heard of those games, Fawn and London and Son of Sea are both games that Alexis developed in the Gothic tradition, text-based, but very much a video game.
But Machine Cares, which is one of the other games that I worked on at Fail Better, although nobody's ever heard of it because it's a complicated story, and Cultist Simulator, which is obviously a game we built at Weather Factory.
Woohoo! Represent by the game.
Both of those use the first person, although it's the player. And
they do, and it's not annoying, actually. I'd never really thought about that. I really do find the sort of you quite patronising in literature, but there's something about it being used in a game which feels natural. And I have not grown up. I'm a bit younger than you, so I didn't get a chance to experience the true kind of interactive
game
fiction
stuff.
Parser
experience,
all the game book stuff. So there's never really been a fashion, while I've been, you know, roughly conscious, for having this sort of you do this, you do that. But for some reason in games it really works. I don't know why.
I think, well, the interesting thing for me is that most people haven't noticed. It's not something that's often remarked on.
Yeah.
But it's something I found quite tricky when I'm writing it, because it's not unusual for me to write a chunk of text for Cultist Simulator and then realise I've absentmindedly written it in the second person, have to go through. And of course the square bracket text, the meta text in Cultist Simulator, does say you. But the reason I did it is because we found when we were making Machine Cares that, to our surprise, using I created a feeling of distance between the player and the text that wasn't present when you said you, because it implies who's the I? It can't be you, because you're reading it,
that's
and you're not
really
writing it. But so it has to be somebody different. So even though it's in theory more close, it provides a bit of safe interval. And when I was writing Cultist,
I know what it is.
Go on.
Well, I think it will be because I implies an existence. It implies an I, whereas you doesn't actually imply any existence outside of the person who is on the receiving end of you. With the exception of you know, there has to be somebody to say you, just to address the person. But that doesn't seem to sort of snag in the mind. But somebody says I, and immediately you think, well, I didn't write this book. So
yeah,
there must be a sort of second entity who wrote this narrative, who is distinct from me. That's interesting.
So it is. But the reason I did it is specifically because in Cultist, there are a lot of things you do, which are it's reasonable to describe as morally questionable. And, you know, that's part of the point, is it's a game where you're the antagonist some of the time. But I wanted people to feel a bit more distance, so that it's more like reading a post-Lovecraftian diary of somebody who's done weird things than it's about them actually deciding to eat somebody from the skin down or whatever.
Well, that's really interesting you bring that up, because this isn't gothic. It's later than that. It's 1950s. But this makes me think very much of Lolita, Vladimir Nabokov's infamous book. Mm. That certainly makes you, as a father of a 10-year-old girl, feel very uncomfortable. And it's slightly less uncomfortable reading for me, just because I don't feel quite as sort of specified. Mm-hmm. But of course, that does exactly what you've just said about cultists, that deliberately places the reader in a slightly complicit relationship mm-hmm. with the narrator, who's very charming and who totally isn't trustworthy. And it makes the reader engage with a story that most people in this world would say is the worst story of all. You know, abusing a kid and sexually assaulting a kid and raping a kid is, you know, most people think that's absolutely bottom of the list. And if he had done it in a way that used a much more trustworthy, distanced narrative technique, if he'd said, you know, Humbert Humbert did X, most people's response would be pretty simple. It would be, well, Humbert Humbert is a douchebag and Humbert Humbert should go to prison, because that's the sort of stuff you read about in the newspaper. But the way that he chose to make Humbert Humbert the narrator, you intrinsically get this sense of slight kinship between the reader and the author, because the person speaking through the text is taking the reader on their journey.
There's a sort of, what's the word? It's like he's confiding in you. That's the sense of it.
Yeah, I think he, you know, we talk a lot when we hear people, celebrities or people we don't know terribly well on some form of media, talking the truth about themselves. We talk about it as sort of opening up and being vulnerable. And there's definitely a vulnerability about Humbert Humbert that you wouldn't normally get from coverage of a man doing really awful things. And I think it's just brilliantly clever, because it doesn't say Humbert Humbert's a great chap apart from all of this stuff. But it also allows you to engage with a really difficult topic in a way that most people are just like, nope, that's a line for me and I'm not going to do it. And that's why it's so controversial, obviously, because lots of people just feel that it's not comfortable.
So my experience with, I think we talked about this, my experience with Lolita was, so I love Nabokov. There you go, hot take. Nabokov is a good writer. But I particularly love the firework effect of his prose. There's this sort of persistent legend, maybe a myth, that he had synesthesia. It makes a lot of sense. But I couldn't finish Lolita. I made it three quarters of the way through, past a lot of the stuff that I think is probably nastiest, and I just sort of ran out of endurance. And to be clear, if anybody wants to burn a copy of Lolita, I want to burn them. I think literature, especially literature of that quality, but even literature of any quality, gets a fucking pass. Freedom of expression is king. And the fact that I couldn't finish it doesn't mean it's a bad book.
Well, and you shouldn't feel obligated to. No. You know, it's deliberately setting out to do something difficult. And if you don't want to read that, that's fine.
But the particular thing, so I think I had a like 3, 5 or whatever she was, daughter at the time, which probably contributed to my discomfort.
Definitely.
But also, the thing that really finished it for me is I started to feel that Nabokov was, because he's a fucking genius, deliberately paralleling the sort of confiding intimacy of Humbert Humbert with the fact that he's describing quite an unpleasant story in absolutely pellucid, fascinating prose. So there's this real feeling of corruption, that you're reading a horrible story in a wonderful voice. And I thought, you know, I reckon Nabokov is doing this deliberately because he knows what he's doing.
I suspect.
And I respect him doing it, but I don't think I want to stick around for any more of it.
No, and I think that's something he's actually commented on personally. He said that, you know, apart from the controversy and apart from the fact that I think he and most people would consider it his masterwork, there was a lot of debate about people not liking it and picking it up. And that debate was not so much actually that they felt complicit in a difficult narrative that they didn't want to talk about, but was because a lot of people picked it up thinking it was going to be an erotic novel. Because, you know, let's face it, there is this uneasy distinction between youth and beauty and, you know, the male voyeuristic narrative of looking at a younger woman who's very attractive and who's having sexual fantasies about her. And a lot of that is very healthy and normal, and a lot of people would like to read a book that is about that. I mean, bodice ribbers are basically that, you know, from a male or female perspective. So a lot of people picked up Lolita expecting it to be a sort of slightly naughty tale about maybe a slightly young lady. And apparently Nabokov said, you know, the first 13 chapters are deliberately erotic. They are meant to make you feel those things that Humbert Humbert feels and make you understand the sexual attraction that this guy has for this young girl. But basically beyond that point, and, you know, there's something like 40, 50, 60 chapters, it's a really depressing, miserable tale of the sort of once brilliant pipe dream from Humbert Humbert's perspective turning out to be the reality of, you know, taking advantage of a child, which isn't a fun ride and nobody has a good time. And Nabokov said, you know, people came into the book expecting one thing, got halfway through and realised the book actually was going in a different direction and got really fed up and left it. So apparently there were lots of people who have not finished Lolita but have started it for a very different reason than you did. But it's obviously got multiple things going on.
Parenthetically, because this is veering off topic.
Yes.
My favourite... No, what I'm about to say is veering off topic. My favourite Nabokov, I just want to recommend, I don't think it's his best, but it's what I like most, is the Lushin Defence. Because it's particularly about addiction to games, in particular chess,
what?
And about the context, yeah. And it's worth mentioning, just very briefly, Stefan Zweig, who wrote, among other things, stories which inspired the Grand Budapest Hotel. Zweig wrote a novella or short story called A Chess Story, which touches on very similar themes to the Lushin Defence. And if you have an interest in the way that humans interact with games, and the way that was relevant long before video games are a thing, then The Lushin Defence and Stefan Zweig's A Chess Story are both very good reads.
Good rec. But back to... Let's
reliable narrators!
To the Gothic. Shall I go on the Gothic trope bit? Shall I just explain the context?
You can. I think I do... Before we talk about Gothic, I want to talk about statistics. And I think the thing we came back to with reliable narrators... No, it's a statistician's adage that you laughed at, actually. I mean, that caused you to laugh because it was funny, which is all models are wrong, but some are useful.
And that's such a good...
Yeah. And, you know, any time somebody tells you a story, there will be inaccuracies almost immediately. Mm. But that doesn't mean it's untrue in any meaningful way.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean it's useless, far from it.
Yeah.
But you're going to talk about the Gothic, or I can talk about relevance theory.
I mean, choose your poison. You do relevance theory. I'll come in later.
So, as you probably are aware, if you've sat through one of these things before, I bumbled my way through a linguistics degree. And one of the things that struck home for me was Deirdre Wilson and Dan Sperber's work on relevance theory. And here's the gist of it. We tend to think, especially if we come from a technological background, about utterances, language, as meaning that gets wrapped up and put in a box and passed across to somebody else. They then unwrap it. You encode something the same way you encode a packet going down a fiber optic line, and then it gets decoded at the other end, and what pops into their brain is the thought you intended to put there. And this obviously isn't the way language works at anything but the most primitive level. So here's the canonical example is, I say to you, it's raining. Now, you probably know it's raining. So if I'm saying to you it's raining, that might mean that you're blind, or it might mean that it's raining too quietly for you to hear. Most likely it means, I think your plan to go to the cinema is a bad idea because we'll get wet. But I don't say that. I say it's raining. And so you get this really basic coding effect of I've transmitted information about the weather, which you already know. And all the important stuff is the contextual effect. And what Sperber and Wilson proposed, which makes sense to me, is that with a speaker and a listener, both assume that the speaker is trying to say something that requires the minimum of effort to understand, but has the maximum of contextual effect, like will have the biggest change on the person's mental state. So that's why if you say, it's raining, so I don't think we should go to the cinema because we'll get wet, which is uncomfortable, then I sound like an alien pretending to be a human.
I would get very, very bored of that with you.
Because the contextual effect, the ratio of contextual effect to processing effort is really low. But if I say, my freaking daughter does this all the time, she'll say the first letter of the word, she's like, Daddy, it's ruh. And I have to guess it's raining. So again, you've got sort of very, very, very high processing effort for very limited contextual
effect.
Can I ask
what might be quite a bad question as somebody who didn't do a linguistics degree? The thing that immediately pops into my head...
I only got a
2-2. Well, cancelling the podcast. The thing that immediately pops into my head is the very, very important moments of transmission of information. So, for example, the phrase, look out.
Yes.
Look out very rarely says, look out because directly yeah. above you is scaffolding that has come loose and a man is about to drop a brick on your head. Mm-hmm. Because if you were going to say all that, the person would be dead and the point of the transmission of information would be moot. So is that... So as a sort of armchair non-scientist, which is the best person
like
to
linguists
lead
these, scientists.
is that because kind of when we were monkeys, like it was most important that we had this very quick transmission of information that we would expect the other party to contextualise, or is that totally?
I think it's so. Again, I'm just talking now, right? I don't have any view on the evolutionary biology of linguistics, really, but. I think it's all a general instance of the specific thing you're talking about, because it takes time and effort to speak and it takes time and effort to listen. So over time, you're going to want to maximise the value that both people get out of that.
Yeah.
My favourite thing about word resonance theory is echoic mention, because it's very hard to explain things like sarcasm or irony in terms of traditional models of how utterances work. And the idea of echoic mention is when you're being sarcastic, you are mimicking a person or a potential person and implying that you don't agree with what the person's saying.
Linguistic straw man.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I guess to tie this back to the reliable or unreliable mm-hmm. narrator theme, what you're saying is that language intrinsically actually has this slightly, what's the word, subjective existence. There is no actual true linguistic reality, because what you mean is not necessarily what I will interpret it to mean.
I think
we are getting into philosophy here. We need more jokes. Back to bums.
You said it. I think that's true. I think it's not so much what's true as what we care about. And this is so Forster. Fucking love for is it H.M. Forster? I can't remember what it is.
E.M.
Forster. So
he does seem like a very nice man.
He does seem like a very nice man.
But then I love a sad man.
So he did a series of lectures which got collected up in a book, Aspects of the Novel. And one of the things that Forster said is that all novels, the thing they all have in common, in as much as any novel, all has everything in common, is that they all have a story. And you know, you get novels which don't have a story in the traditional sense, but it's basically one of the common things of novels is they're longish and they have a story. And he said the story is the lowest element of the novel. It's like a spine, or even, here we go, bums, a tapeworm. And it just sort of goes through the whole thing, and without it, it's not a story. It's the most basic form. He cites Scheherazade, and he says Scheherazade didn't survive because her characters were good, or her themes were compelling. She survived because she understood how to do suspense.
Mm.
And so the king really cared about what was going to happen next.
Mm.
And that is the fundamental thing. He's very rude about Sir Walter Scott and says Sir Walter Scott basically can't write, but he can do suspense, which is why he's so successful. You know, I think you'd probably say the same thing about Dan Brown. Dan Brown is brilliant at suspense and the writing is awful, but he really understands how to do cliffhangers, so he's very, very readable. And but he says the thing about a good novel is you have the life of time, which is the story. You have what things happen when. And then you have the life of value. Because if we think back over our lives, you don't think of them in terms of calendars or maps.
Mm.
We think of them as a series of events, some of which bulk large and some of which bulk small. So that seems, I think, to tie into relevance theory, in that when you're telling a story, you care and you want the reader to care about things, whether they happen explicitly or implicitly or whatever. And it's a decision about what to make the reader care about that's important. And that comes back to games as well, because you systematise the mechanics that you want people to care about.
It's interesting that you say that, because one of the key examples of a Gothic story that really digs into this reliability of its narrator is The Turn of the Screw.
Which I know you love.
Well, I have a tendency to have very strong opinions, not necessarily based on any knowledge whatsoever. So I did have a bit of a feud with my dad for years when he would maintain that The Turn of the Screw was the best thing that had ever been written. And I would maintain, just as definitely that it was definitely not the best thing that had ever been written, and cite his love of Dickens as proof that I was right. And eventually I read it, and it turned out that my father was right. And it's a really good book.
Did you say your father was right?
No, that was Echo, some unreliable narrator. Anyway, the point is, The Turn of the Screw is probably the most cited example of this being used exceptionally well. And I recommend that you read it if you haven't. It's not super long. Henry James has a tendency to write very long sentences, but he's an excellent writer, so you can get through them. And the basic premise is it's Christmas Eve, and a bunch of people are gathering together to tell specifically kind of spooky stories. And somebody has this manuscript that they say is from a governess they know who is now dead. And they read this manuscript, and that takes the majority of the rest of the story. And it tells the story of a governess who is, long story short, sent to look after two children. There's some questions about why she was chosen and what her feelings are about the position, but all the way through, the children are lovely, and we think they're great, and she thinks they're great. And there's a kind of question mark over the little boy and why he's been sent back from school. That's kind of a cloud that we're not really sure about. And over time, she starts seeing, the governess starts seeing, these two ghosts around the property, a man and a woman, and she ends up being convinced that each one of them has a particular attachment to one of the children that she is guarding, and that she also becomes aware that the children can see the ghosts too. So it becomes this very stressful story of this governess trying to protect her wards, whom she loves, and it all goes pear-shaped. And there's this very, very famous ending, quite abrupt, quite shocking, which leaves a lot of questions unanswered. And there's been a huge debate over time, because it's a brilliant story that has captured people's imaginations, over how much of the narrative we can actually believe from this governess. You know, maybe she's just telling the truth and it's just a good old spooky ghost story that's a bit scary. Great. Maybe she is deliberately not telling the truth because she is in some way less neutral than we think. Maybe she has a mental issue, which means she is not actually capable of telling the right story. Or maybe there's a big bunch of criticism that says, you know, from a psychoanalytic feminist postmodern reading, it's all about sexual repression, which is also in there, but also doesn't tell the whole story. And ultimately, lady bums, I suppose. But ultimately, the critique has kind of fizzled out because somebody in the New York Times in the 60s sort of said the best thing about it, and we were like, oh yeah, he's right. And he said that basically trying to work out what the truth actually is beautifully takes and chips away at the excellence of the story itself, because quite clearly Henry James did not want us to take away one particular narrative. He clearly wanted us to take away everything at once and have lots of questions over what really happened and what, you know, who she is, and it's the ambiguity itself that is the point of the story, not the actual linear number of events that led up to the plot.
I mean obviously you're right, and I think that crystallizes for me one of the things about reliable narrators is that we actually really, really want reliable narrators. And one of the hallmarks of
it's bedtime stories, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say something different. I was going to say geek culture. People want to know what canon is. So this is something that comes up in Cultist Simulator all the time. And of course, one of the things that in Cultist Simulator is that there are multiple valid versions of what's happened, you know, so what the histories are. But for example, I was always entertained that Star Wars...
I knew you were going to go here.
Yeah, there was a wiki which classified canonicity at four levels. So there's the lowest level... was just stuff that it was handed in the expanded universe, and then there was stuff that had happened in the sort of less well-regarded films, and then there was stuff that had happened in the actual films, but then the G level was stuff that George Lucas himself had said. So if Luke Skywalker had said one thing in the first Star Wars film and George Lucas said something that contradicted what appeared to be the case in the universe, then that was ipso facto more correct. And they stopped doing that anyway, and I don't imagine it hold up very well now. Lucas sold the rights for $4 million, but
as little as that,
people was, yeah, well, there was a lot of debate about whether it was a lot or a little, because it's a lot for a creative property.
I think if I had sold Star Wars for $4 million,
billion, yes,
that makes a lot more sense. No. I was thinking, what an idiot.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, go back.
And We really want to believe in the fundamental reality of something we love. Laura Miller, who is something fancy like the New York Times book critic, or used to be, wrote a sort of perplexed and quite cross, very readable literary biography called The Magician's Book, in which she talked about how she loved C.S. Lewis when she was growing up, and she still has this tremendous fondness for Narnia, which she finds very difficult to reconcile with her sort of sophisticated literary apprehension of some of the more naive things in it, not to mention the fact the whole thing's a gigantic Trojan horse intended to smuggle Christianity into the minds of unsuspecting children.
Yeah, that's
children,
where he lost me.
Which she hated. And she but one of the things she said that stayed with me is that she really wanted to believe that there was an enchanted door or wardrobe that she could step through and end up in Narnia. There was some fundamental reality that Lewis had a connection to. And when you really love a world or a setting or a story, that's often what we feel. We want to have a direct connection to it. And I think that's why we look for reliable narrators, because if there is a reliable narrator who's telling you what, big air quotes, actually happened, then you can participate more excitingly in the reality of it. Quick plug for a book. I can't remember the author, but you can find it easy enough.
Is it a plug if you haven't written it?
No, it's not. Yeah, not a plug. Quick enthusiasm. It's called As If. I think it's called As If, the Literary Prehistory of Virtual Reality.
What?
Yeah. I can't remember the author, but it's a fun survey.
I will find it and put it in the notes to this episode.
Please do. It's a fun survey of the way that our sort of understanding of shared or built worlds developed through Lovecraft, Tolkien, Conan Doyle, around all of whom our understanding of what, air quotes, actually happened in a story and the ironic distance of understanding it wasn't real but has internal consistency was reconfigured.
You see, I mean, this podcast has been all interesting and all that jazz, but, like, it's been a disaster because we haven't talked about Lovecraft at all, and I had loads of things to say about it, but the key takeaway that I discovered while thinking about the topic was that he doesn't use unreliable narrators. We have a number of people who go mad. That's quite a traditional
trope.
That's
a good point.
But he creates this really frightening narrative. Never once do we think, but do the old ones exist? It's like, no, they do. They're upstairs. One of them has a flute. One of them is made of legs. And the other one sits in the forest and has babies every night, and they're really horrible. But that's never in question. And it's astonishing because the whole of Lovecraft's kind of style is about the things that you see at the corner of your eye and the things that you can't comprehend because we're tiny little flesh bugs on the earth. And if you do, your brain will explode. But he does all that with this fundamental core that what he is talking about is true. And I think we should do a whole different podcast about that, because we're out of time.
I think we should. Very briefly, I can think of one exception, but I think the exception very much demonstrates
that you're basically
right. Is it the temple?
The temple is an exception, but I'm going to ignore it.
Is that the one where the twist, sorry for the spoiler, is that he turns out to have been dead?
It's the twist that it's a German submarine.
No,
Captain.
I don't know that one.
I know, exactly.
But there's the one where somebody escapes from what they think is like their ancestral home, and it turns out they've basically been in a tube, and they see themselves in a mirror, and they realise.
I don't think I've read that one. And there's lots of stuff woven through
notes,
it, but I guess my point is not so much that the narrator is unreliable, because, like I said, it's very common for the narrator to be mentally unhinged, certainly at the end of the story, if not at the start. But it's that they are seemingly always experiencing this objective reality. We don't really get the turn of the screw effect of, like, this person was bonkers, so maybe the story that they've told us is something we can't rely on. There's never that suggestion. It's always like, no, there was a Shoggoth in that cave, and then he's mad.
Yeah, you're right.
And
yeah.
I just think that's fascinating.
I think there's, extremely briefly, Gene Wolfe, a lot of Gene Wolfe's narrators are unreliable, and they're often sort of explicitly unreliable. Like, there's what soldier, the protagonist is a soldier in the mist, has a sort of memento like memory disorder that means he can't remember things from day to day unless he writes them down, and so his diary is theoretically objective record, but obviously it's not objective. And Gene Wolfe's trick that he does, and I love Gene Wolfe, God rest his soul, but he does this part, it's annoying sometimes, is basically you'll think you'll know what's going on in the story, and then in like chapter 5 he'll casually mention the whole thing has been happening like inside a cat's nose, as if you should have known this all along, and it's reconfigures everything, and it's brilliant. It takes a lot of discipline to do it, but that sort of happening not to mention is, I think, one of the subtler and more interesting forms of unreliable narration, because it doesn't feel like it usually doesn't feel like it breaches the contract with the reader.
Well, I was going to say not in Murder Mystery. We talked briefly about this off air when I mentioned that Agatha Christie has made use of the unreliable narrator several times in her books, and people really do feel betrayed, because the whole point of engaging with a murder mystery is, can you work out who did it? Basically, it's a whodunit. It's not a who says they didn't and then turns out for reasons that were not available to me actually did it. But anyway, we do need to end because people have lives to live, I suppose. So We have to do another one on Unreliable Narrators, yeah. I think. Well, that is the noise of the computer telling us to shut the heck up. So thank you so much for listening. I will put all of the notes from today's discussion in the episode summary so you can read it and tell us what you think. And have a spooky day.